Good morning. My name is Raymond, for those who don't know me. I'm going to be reading the Bible for us. Today's reading comes from Exodus chapter 1, from verse 1 to the end of the chapter. And if you have one of the pew Bibles, at least mine is on page 55. So that's Exodus chapter 1. These are the names of the sons of Israel who went to Egypt with Jacob, each with his family: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah; Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin; Dan and Naphtali; Gad and Asher. The descendants of Jacob numbered 70 in all. Joseph was already in Egypt. Now Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died, but the Israelites were fruitful and multiplied greatly and became exceedingly numerous, so that the land was filled with them. Then a new king, who did not know about Joseph, came to power in Egypt. "Look," he said to his people, "the Israelites have become much too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous, and if war breaks out, will join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country." So they put slave masters over them to oppress them with forced labor, and they built Pithom and Ramses as store cities for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. So the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. They made their lives bitter and hard labor in brick and mortar with all kinds of work in the fields. In all their hard labor, the Egyptians used them ruthlessly. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, whose names were Shiphrah and Puah, "When you help the Hebrew women in childbirth and observe them on the delivery stool, if it is a boy, kill him. But if it is a girl, let her live." The midwives, however, feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. Then the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and asked them, "Why have you done this? Why have you let the boys live?" The Hebrew midwives answered Pharaoh, "Hebrew women are not like Egyptian women. They are vigorous and give birth before the midwives arrive." So God was kind to the midwives, and the people increased and became even more numerous. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families of their own. Then Pharaoh gave this order to all his people: "Every boy that is born you must throw into the Nile, but let every girl live."
Good morning. We haven't updated as a family that will merge into an intro for the sermon. We've been home together this week, which has been wonderful. Lara had chemo on Monday, and surprise to us, they discharged her the same day. So before this week, Lara had been home 3 nights in the past 3.5 weeks, and it was wonderful to have everyone under the same roof. Lara's latest results reveal no more leukemia in her bone marrow. I was a bit worried about doing this intro, which is great. And the hospital rang this week to tell us that the schedule's a little further on than we expected. 2 weeks of this intense 6 months to go. And then we go into 18 months of maintenance, but they tell us that's significantly easier. This has been the hardest season of our life. And I think I'm still coming to terms with everything that's happened, because it all happened so quickly. It was just this precautionary hospital visit and a blood test, just to be sure, on a Thursday. And then by Monday, a 2-year-old was on chemotherapy. Those first few weeks were horrible. A blur of shock, all this new information about all the new drugs and whatever, and just sadness. We've come to terms with the information, but the shock and the sadness have continued. Amongst all this, we are so thankful for you, for our church family who have cared for us in so many ways and prayed for us. I was hesitant to speak about this, but, you know, sometimes people expect you to say something profound when you go through this. It's revealed to me that I am not in control. Should have learnt that one a little sooner, I'm sure. But I reckon life tricks you into thinking you are in control. You must take responsibility for your life. It's instilled from my parents, but it's true, isn't it? If you want to have lunch today, take some responsibility for it. Don't just expect it to kind of just fall from the sky, but I think responsibility tricks you into thinking you're in control. You have to take responsibility. But there's a huge difference between taking responsibility for your life and being in control of your life. And so for all the good responsibilities that you have and we have, and for all the power and influence you might yield in those circles, and for however well organised and prepared you are, we are not in control. And a time will come, if it hasn't already, when you will feel powerless. This is because you and I are not God. And what we need at times like this are not simple Christian bumper sticker mottos. We need to know who God is. I need to know God. Spurgeon would preach, "Oh, there is in contemplating Christ a balm for every wound. In musings on the Father, there is a quietus for every grief. And in the influence of the Holy Spirit, there is a healing for every sore. Would you lose yourself in sorrow? Would you drown in your cares? Then go plunge yourself into the Godhead's deepest sea. Be lost in his immensity, and you shall come forth as from the couch of rest, refreshed and invigorated. I know nothing which can comfort the soul, calm the billowing of sorrow and grief, speak peace to the winds of trial, than to look into God." Exodus is about God. Now, of course you say, thank you, Captain Obvious, every book of the Bible is about God. And yet, the events of Exodus are especially designed to teach us about God. You know, it's such a well-known book. We learn all the events if we had a church upbringing. The burning bush, the plagues, the Exodus, Mount Sinai, maybe even the golden calf. We learn the events, but maybe we have failed to connect the dots from the events to the God we trust. They are designed that we would know him. So, Exodus chapter 6, "I will take you as my own people and I will be your God. Then you will know that I am the Lord." Well, Moses, in his reply to Pharaoh, "It will be as you say, so that you may know there is no one like the Lord our God." And even a non-Israelite, Jethro, a little bit later will say, "Praise be to the Lord who rescued you from the hand of the Egyptians and of Pharaoh, and who rescued the people from the hand of the Egyptians. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all other gods." The book of Exodus is about knowing God. It's in Exodus that we learn the personal name of God. It's in Exodus that we hear Moses see a bit of the Lord, and he'll proclaim, the Lord, the gracious and compassionate God." The book of Exodus is about knowing God. So after each sermon, we'll need to ask the question, what does this tell me about God? And so in turning to the opening of this book this morning, we turn to the first two chapters, only to struggle to find God. God's presence is so subtle in the opening chapters that some think he's absent. When Pharaoh violently forced Israel into slave labour, where was God? When Pharaoh plans to exterminate Hebrew children, where was God? Had God left his people? Now, this may well be an issue that we wrestle with in our lives. Where is God? And how on earth can God be sovereign when he seems to be absent and everything is falling apart? But I think a close reading will help us see that God is more than just in the background. He's actually in control and advancing his purposes even at a moment like this. Now, the first, admittedly subtle sign of God's sovereignty is in Israel's experience of blessing. Exodus continues the story of the sons of Jacob, only to reveal they are no longer just a family. They're turning into a nation. And so the names are listed there, and then we read of how, verse 6, Joseph and all his brothers and all that generation died, but the Israelites were exceedingly fruitful. They multiplied greatly, increased in number, and became so numerous that the land was filled with them. The families of Jacob's sons have grown to such a size that they're now considered a people. So great are they that Pharaoh will identify them as a people in verse 9. He identifies the people of the Israelites. No longer just a muddled up family, they are becoming a nation, as God said they would. This fruitfulness is a subtle sign of God's sovereignty, because God said, speaking to Israel, to Jacob, in a vision at night, "Jacob, Jacob, here I am," he replied, "I am the God of your father. Do not be afraid to go down to Egypt, for I will make you into a great nation there. I will go down to Egypt with you." God has said that he would make Israel's sons into a great nation because God had made a covenant with Abraham, a covenant that would see blessing go from Israel out to the ends of the earth. In this covenant, we see the Creator's intentions for his world. What blessing is this that will go to the ends of the earth? Well, look carefully with me in Exodus chapter 1. When we look carefully at verse 7 of the first chapter, we read that the Israelites were exceedingly fruitful. They multiplied greatly, increased in numbers, and became so numerous the land was filled with them. And hearing this, we're reminded of God's intentions for creation. The language of fruitfulness and multiplied and increased, it comes straight from Genesis 1. And it comes from Genesis 9 too, when God starts again after the flood. The blessing that Israel experienced reminds us of God's intentions for creation. The point being, the Creator has not given up on his world, nor his intentions for it. This here is redemption, properly understood. God is in the process of regaining his creation. He grabs his people and restates his purposes for them and for the whole world. And so as Israel experiences blessing, they're testament to God's redemption of his creation. But of course, this fruitfulness will not be interpreted positively by everyone. We read in verse 8 of a new king coming to power. A king who did not know Joseph, which is not an issue of ignorance, such as defiance. A previous generation, a previous Pharaoh, knew and benefited from Joseph's wisdom. But this rise of a new king signals a change of policy towards the Hebrews, a policy of oppression. The Pharaoh, this new Pharaoh, he arises and then he appeals to the people of Egypt. Look, verse 9. "The Israelites have become far too numerous for us. Come, we must deal shrewdly with them, or they will become even more numerous. And if war breaks out, we'll join our enemies, fight against us, and leave the country." But there's something really important here I want you to observe. Note with me, this is not just the oppression of tyrant over people, the Hebrews. The Egyptians, as a nation, follow suit. So verse 11, they put slave masters over them to oppress them. Verse 12, the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites and worked them ruthlessly. Verse 14, they made their lives bitter with harsh labour. In all the harsh labour, the Egyptians worked them ruthlessly. So scarier than just a policy of a single tyrant is actually the bureaucracy that fulfills the vision of the tyrant. I mean, how do you oppress a whole people group? By and large, with the aid of another people group.
The policy may well come from the top, but you need management and administration to make it all happen. And this is what happens. A pharaoh and a nation unite to oppose the covenant people. And so they unite in opposing the very plans of God to redeem his creation. There will be exceptions along the way, but I think this is important to appreciate for when we come to the plagues. For God's judgment will be on the whole nation, not just Pharaoh. This is a picture of a nation opposing God by seeking to crush his people. First, with cruel labour. Now, I've found a quote of the process of brickmaking in the ancient world. I found this quite helpful. Imagine this. A rustic fortress with walls 7 or 8 feet high to keep brick poachers out and to keep slave labourers in. These fortresses have a dark, otherworldly presence to them because of the dust and smoke that hang constantly in the air. The kilns require extra labour because someone has to stoke the charcoal constantly to keep them at their optimum temperature. Before the bricks are ready for the kiln, they must be shaped and pre-dried in the sun. All day long, slaves perform the backbreaking labour of packing wet clay and straw into moulds that form the bricks. They slap the clay into the moulds, forming row after row. Then other workers, usually children, carry the bricks on their heads to set them out in the sun to dry. When they're dry enough to fire, the slaves carry them to the kiln to be baked, hour after hour, day after day, weeks that flow into months, months that turn into years, backbreaking work. This is how the nation of Egypt sought to crush God's people. And yet, we read in verse 12, but the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread. Here's the second sign of God's sovereignty. Israel's survival of this oppression. It's testament to God's hand. Even when Pharaoh attempts a more violent response to Israel, namely to kill their baby boys by commanding, verse 15, the Hebrew midwives, but then ordering, verse 22, the nation to throw every Hebrew boy into the Nile, Israel's survival, even in this circumstance, is not luck. Because, verse 17, the midwives feared God and did not do what the king of Egypt had told them to do. They let the boys live. God's hand here, too, is working subtly, working through those who fear him. And I think there's something here for us to consider. Note with me, the fear of God leaves these women to disobey and defy the house rules. And a similar thing will happen with Moses. The Pharaoh's daughter will rescue the Hebrew baby and take him in, not explicitly out of fear for God, but actually out of an attribute of God. She'll do it because of compassion. Now, I think this means at least two things. First, this is a mockery of Pharaoh's power. Two defiant midwives can undo his plans. Even his own daughter will defy him. Secondly, note with me how these acts of disobedience are prized. The midwives are rewarded with families of their own, verse 21, and the daughter of Pharaoh is graced. Chapter 2, verse 10, he became a son for her. Now, undoubtedly, the scriptures call us to submit to authorities, because God has established authorities. And yet, there are a number of examples through the scriptures when submission to authorities cannot be reconciled with submission to God. Daniel's often the case in point. Daniel won't pray to an idol. But here we find humanitarian grounds for defying oppressive authorities. Now, before our authoritarian spirits get too excited because of our convict, past. Note with me, there is no assurance here that these midwives would have escaped the consequences when they decided to do this. Reminding us that our fear of God and compassion for people may cause us to disobey authorities, but then we may have to face the consequences. And the criteria here, let's underline it. Disobedience to authority is based not on popular topics. In fact, I suspect they will be very unpopular topics. But nonetheless, our fear of God and compassion for people may well compel us to voice disagreement and even defy authorities. Now, we might want to know what does that all that look like, but we've got a principle here that we need to carefully apply to different scenarios, and I think to give too many specifics would be to go beyond what I can do, but there is a principle, isn't there? That we don't just follow the crowd, but our fear of God and our compassion for people would actually say to the crowd, that's wrong. And we might even say to the authorities who say to do this, we say, no, I can't do that. And I suspect this is a challenge for many brothers and sisters across the world. Israel remains under oppression. They're preserved, but they're not free. In fact, they're serving their oppressor. Will this predicament change? Well, enter Moses. And his beginnings are so well known, it's probably a little bit hard to appreciate this story again. But let me try all the same. Have you ever noticed that Moses lacks an identity? So chapter 2, verse 1, a man of the tribe of Levi married a Levite woman, and she became pregnant and gave birth to a son. When she saw that he was a fine child, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got a papyrus basket for him and coated it with tar and pitch. Then she placed the child in it and put it among the reeds along the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to see what would happen to him. But even in verse 6, Moses, who doesn't have a name yet, is just seen as one of the Hebrew babies. We know what his name's going to be, but he lacks an identity to start with. A boy with no name grows up with a foot in two worlds. He is a Hebrew, but he'll grow up in Pharaoh's courts. He will be called Moses, which in Hebrew means drawn out of water, but in Egyptian means son. Do you see the identity issue? Who will this man be? Well, we've got two early pictures of us to help us, and this identity theme continues. In the first, we see him identify with his own people. So look with me to chapter 2, verse 11. One day, after Moses had grown up, he went out to where his own people were and washed them at their hard labour. He saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his own people, looking this way and that, and seeing no one, he killed the Egyptian and hit him in the sand. Now, whatever we make of that, we might have questions for that a bit later, whatever we make of that, notice how it becomes a question of identity. Verse 13, the next day he went out and saw the two Hebrews fighting. He asked the one in the wrong, why are you hitting your fellow Hebrew? The man said, who made you ruler? Who made you judge over us? So Moses identifies with his own people and he acts, and then some of his people reject him and ask, who do you think you are? It's an identity issue, isn't it? And an identity issue continues after this. The news spreads. Pharaoh has to flee for his life. We get the second picture of him. He flees to Midian. He sits down by a well. Verse 16, now a priest of Midian had 7 daughters, and they came to draw water and filled the troughs to water from their father's flock. Some shepherds came along and drove them away, but Moses got up and came to their rescue. Moses succeeds here at protecting, but look at how this scene ends. The daughters think, verse 19, an Egyptian rescued us. The same man who identified with his people, the Hebrews, now seems content to be identified as an Egyptian. He names his son foreigner. Has Moses resigned from his people's oppression? Who will this man be? Well, come back next week. The true hero of the story enters in the last few verses, though he's been present all along. God's hand blessed and preserved Israel. And in some ways, God's explicit entry is like the hero coming at the end of the episode, just before the credits roll. His entry signals so much, and yet we have to wait to next week to see what he'll do. This episode concludes with the camera kind of panning out during that long period. The king of Egypt died, the Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out. And their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God. While Israel experienced this blessing and survived this oppression, note with me, it is not obvious that this was a time of patient trusting in God. In fact, conspicuously absent is a reference to Israel calling out to God. Now, I don't know how you've read this passage before, but it doesn't say they called out to God. It says they called out, and their crying went up to God. And you all need to think about, well, were they calling out to God, or am I just sort of bringing that to the passage? Because in the weeks to come, we will see in Israel that's not quite ready to obey the Lord. I suspect they are not crying out to God. And yet, nonetheless, verse 24, God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites. And the last word is, God knew. And it just sort of leaves it there. So the stage is set for God to act decisively. What have we seen of the God, of this God so far? Well, Exodus reminds us this picture of God, a God who is in control. If we draw out from Israel's blessing and preservation, we would have to say God's sovereignty is not proved when all is well. God's sovereignty is not proved when our lives go on happily ever after. Neither is God's sovereignty under question when everything falls apart. These are not the criteria of evaluation. Rather, God's sovereignty is proved when his promises continue to unfold. Please do not test God by what he has not promised. Test him by what he has promised. God's sovereignty is most clearly seen in the coming of his Son, his death and resurrection, and the good news being preached to the nation. Luke in the New Testament uses this creation language to show how God's purposes are continuing to be fulfilled. We hear of the word of God continuing to increase. Disciples multiplied. The word of God increased and multiplied. This is the language we find in Genesis now being applied to the gospel going forward. Because now we are not looking for a nation to produce kids. The Messiah of that nation has come, and the blessing to the nations is to find life in the Son. And so as this word goes forward through the book of Acts, Luke uses this language of God's purposes for creation continuing as the gospel increases and disciples multiply. We await the redemption of creation. Exodus reminds us of the plan of God to redeem his creation so that we might know him. I think pastorally, I'd want to say that God's sovereign hand is rarely discernible. It's hard to find out exactly what God is doing at times of suffering. Much time can be lost looking for it. Later, from the perspective of hindsight, we might see some of the results, perseverance, character, hope, but this does not tell us why. I do not know why Lara has leukemia. Can God use it to produce perseverance in Allison and the boys and all of us? Yes, but that is a result. That doesn't tell me why. We need to trust that God is at work in our present circumstances, whatever they may be. And surely the comfort is not us knowing why why God uses all the messiness and all the pain. Surely the comfort is knowing that God sees and hears and remembers his people. And so let's resist the pull this morning to make it all about us. Let's see the God who is creator and redeemer. Who is this whose purposes are unstoppable? Who will transform his people's predicament and identity? Who rewards those who fear him? Who will not be opposed but will humble anyone who threatens his purposes? This is Yahweh. And this God promises the redemption of his creation. And even if his people do not call out to him, he'll capture them so they know who he is. Let's pray. Our great, gracious and glorious Father, would you please give us a spirit of wisdom and revelation that we may know you better. We ask that the eyes of our hearts would be enlightened, that we would know the hope to which you have called us, the riches of your glorious inheritance in your saints, and the incomparably great power for us who believe. The power, like the power you exerted when you raised Christ from the dead and seated him at the right hand in the heavenly realms, far above all rule and authority, power and dominion, and every name. Would you help us, Father, know you better?